So the topic that I announced for this practice circle is a phrase, what can you do about the world? And this phrase comes from a story, a Zen story, that's in the Book of Serenity. It is uttered by someone who actually gets rung up or kind of criticized for asking this question, because in this particular case, he is criticized for having mundane views. In other words, caring about what's happening elsewhere instead of what's happening right here in, you know, the present moment. But nevertheless, I think it's a good question today. I think it's a good question for us. There is, of course, some kind of and it's actually somewhat illustrated in this case, which I'm not going to go into. But there's kind of two views presented in the case, and one is that is sort of the traditional Zen view that all really that is important is right here, right now, in this present moment, and attention to just this, attention to, you know, this body and mind, the arising of these thoughts, the moment as we're meeting it, you know, the moment right now as we're meeting it, and who we are as we're meeting it. You know, these are important questions for us for practice. These are really from the introspective tradition of our teaching. These are vital questions that we could say grapple with in Zazen. You know, who am I right now? How am I meeting this moment? So that's one perspective that's presented here, and then, you know, there's another perspective that is more concerned with how am I in relationship to everything that's going on, and everything around me, the whole world. What is, you know, I am not my process, my internal process of meeting the present moment needs to include my social relationships and potentially, you know, the entire environment of my practice, which includes the society I live in and who's governing it and how they're governing it and so forth. Now, in ancient China, that perspective was not, at least in the Zen tradition, you would look long and hard to find examples of that kind of perspective that concerned itself with, you know, the social setting and, you know, who the and what the emperor was up to and so forth. And in fact, Buddhists had to be pretty careful about if they made any kind of talk about how the society was being run, because if they should have wanted to make such statements and so forth, because from time to time the emperor got the idea that Buddhism was kind of competing with him for the attention of the people, and there would be repressions of Buddhism as getting, you know, like the monasteries would be, you know, be seen as getting too powerful, and so the emperor would, you know, there were repressive eras in ancient China. So, you know, that's the kind of historical context, but it kind of laps over to today, I think, and I think today, of course, our concerns are much different than they were, you know, than the monks of the Tang Dynasty faced. I mean, we live in an entirely different world, but still, I think for those of us that practice, there is some tension. There's still some tension between I feel this tension between my desire to deeply practice and understand the Buddha way, to practice right understanding, right intention, right speech, to practice the way of peace and and meditation, peace and ease, and so there, that's a big and that's a strong motivating force in my life and has been for years. And yet I recognize that I live in a society and I live in a particular historic moment. And right now, I think for myself, I feel pretty heartbroken about the particular historic political social moment that I live in at this moment. And so that's what I wanted to talk about tonight, and talk about how you're feeling about, you know, your practice vis-a-vis this particular moment, and what can you do about the world? And I've been getting some particular inspiration myself from reading essays by Reverend Bhikkhu Bodhi, or actually Bhikkhu means monk, so you don't really need to say reverend, just say Bhikkhu Bodhi. Bhikkhu Bodhi is, despite the Indian-sounding name, the Sanskrit-sounding name, he is an American of Jewish heritage, but who went to college like many of you did, but then in the early 70s decamped for Southeast Asia, or actually I believe I want to say Sri Lanka or South India, and studied with a Buddhist teacher there for many years, learned the ancient Pali language, and started doing a lot of translation and writing, he's written quite a few original books as well as translations of ancient texts, and he's been writing and more recently. He has brought forth from within himself a desire to act in the world, to have an influence and impact on the world, and he founded an organization called Buddhist Global Relief, and that it's an anti-poverty organization, an NGO, non-governmental organization that works in various countries around the world, including in the U.S., to relieve hunger and bring health care to impoverished communities. And he's been writing about recently and being interviewed about this moment that we're in. And he's kind of really been helpful to me in clarifying he calls them the domains of our life, and how to negotiate the domains of the inner work that we are engaged in here in this Dharma Center and in our lives and in our Sangha, going on retreat, deeply investigating our karma, deeply investigating mind and so forth, and also, but not leaving out the world. And so I wanted, there's an essay, and I'll put the link in the newsletter for this next week so you can read the whole essay, but this essay is one of several that he has written, and this one is in the form of an interview. I forget which magazine, but some magazine. I think the Bari Institute of Buddhist Studies, I think, interviewed him for this, and it's called Buddhist Ethics in a World in Crisis, or For a World in Crisis. So I'm just going to read a little bit of this, not this whole thing either, just a couple of paragraphs, just to give you a flavor of his perspective, which I've found very helpful and integrative of you know, not leaving out the not leaving the world out of my practice. So I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs. He says, as I now look at our current global situation, I think we can distinguish three major domains of human life. One is the transcendent domain, the sphere of enlightenment and liberation, the realization of nirvanic peace and freedom, which is the aspiration of classical Buddhism. So I think that's our, you know, that's a lot of what we focus on here in this Dharma Center, that those kinds of, you know, we're focusing on the sphere of enlightenment, liberation, and the realization of peace and freedom. But he says there's a second domain, which includes interpersonal ethics as well as our political, social, and economic policies and modes of organization. So that's, you know, the political, social context that we live in. And then he said there's a third domain, which is the natural domain, which includes our physical bodies, other sentient beings, and the natural environment. From my present viewpoint, a spirituality that privileges the transcendent and devalues the social and natural domains, or sees them at best stepping stones to higher realization, is inadequate to our current needs. As I see it, our collective future calls for an integral type of spirituality that can integrate these three domains of human life. And so that's this perspective that I'm finding great succor in. You know, I'm really responding to that myself. Before I became a Buddhist, I was very involved in social action as a younger person, starting with electoral politics and graduating to demonstrations and other vocal expressions of my views, and actually kind of went too far in that direction, and that was one of the things for me that turned me back, you know, to look at myself and back to, you know, toward Buddhism. Or it, you know, around the same time, I found Buddhism, and started kind of shifting my focus from the world and social action to interaction. So I feel, you know, a great kind of resonance with that, and I think that was somewhat Bhikkhu Bodhi's path too. He was an activist as a young man, but then he really went deep into Buddhism and left the country for a number of years. But anyway, so this is one of his conclusions. I feel that today it's incumbent on us Buddhists not to turn away from the sufferings of the world and blithely dismiss them as the intrinsic nature of samsara. Samsara means the endless round of birth and death. Rather, we have to spread our gaze widely and clearly over the global landscape and discern the vast and often excruciating suffering that afflicts the human population and other life forms, especially in those parts of the world that don't ordinarily impinge upon our consciousness. Looking at national and global issues from the standpoint of a Buddhist conscience, We must make the effort to see the deep and hidden webs of causation that lie behind this suffering. Then we must try to find ways to alleviate that suffering effectively and decisively in a spirit and with means that best accord with the Dharma. This applies particularly when suffering emerges from oppressive and exploitive social, economic, and political systems, systems that create systemic or structural suffering. While we ourselves may live in relative comfort and security, these systems crush the lives of billions of people around the world whose faces we will never see and whose names we'll never know, but we can do our share to alleviate that suffering. And you know, of course, that's the wonderful and noble sentiment right there. I mean, and I think, you know, has in the past been a, it's at in some level a driving force of the social and political activity of our country, and it is so painful now to see the for instance the agency for international development, USAID, you know, which was had a great influence and was bringing a very essential life-giving, life-sustaining aid to many poor countries in Africa, Asia, and elsewhere, and that has that work all of a sudden has been dismantled. And to see that happening in, you know, in such a brief period of time with such disregard for and lack of care for the impact and how that could be, I mean, it'd be one thing to, you know, do it, you know, say, well, we need to save some money and do some analysis and see where money could be saved and take time and you know, no doubt you could save some money. But to just, you know, what we're seeing is it just, you know, totally dismantled and taken away, and at the cost of great human suffering, that we probably haven't even begun to see the effects of yet. Well, we've begun to see it, but so the current situation is pretty heartbreaking, and I think probably everybody here knows there's been lots of demonstrations, and there's been, you know, protests, and it, none of it has seemed to have any effect on the course of, you know, the current administration, and they in fact it just keeps going on and getting worse, it seems. So here we are, you know, in this moment, and I don't think we can ignore it. I don't think we can ignore what's going on and simply and only, you know, do our sitting meditation. It's vital that we continue our sitting meditation, and we vital that we, I mean, I have a huge commitment to this, to this Dharma Center and this group, and I don't intend to give it up. But on the other hand, I wish there were two of me, because I would like to be out there. I would like to be out there doing more for this world. And I've given money to this Buddhist Global Relief and other organizations, and you know, there are other ways in which, and I've try to have an impact in this situation as much as it's simply not, you can't even call it a drop in this bucket. But I don't know. I don't know. I thought I was in. I went speaking of the natural world, I went to Montana and this last month and spent 2 weeks there. And we went on a hike, and there was a place in the hike where somebody had ripped a stone out of the ground and decided that the fun thing to do would be to rip this stone out of the ground and throw it off a cliff. And so, you know, this bothered me tremendously. I was really upset about this stone and it not being in its place in the ground, you know. And it had been so there was such carelessness. I felt like this was just maybe it just encapsulated to me the carelessness of what is happening right now in the world and in our country. I want a world where care is taken of everything, including, you know, stones in the ground, you know. I want to leave the stone in the ground. Leave it there, you know. And so, anyway, this, I'm talking way too long, and excuse me very much. So I want to open this up now to you and see what this stimulates in you, and we can go around the circle, and if you want to speak, you can speak. And you know, this is the practice circle format is you just say what you have to say, and people don't crosstalk. They don't say, yeah, Jim, you're right, or no, I don't agree with Jim. You don't do that. You just say what's coming up for you, and not having crosstalk. So, yeah, Larry.
If I may.
Yes.
I think it's good that we have practice circles. I think there should be one more prefatory word spoken, which is that, and I hope you agree. I don't think they can hear. I'm sorry.
I think it's important when we have practice circles that people know they're free to speak in the manner that you just described, and that they're also free not to speak if they want.
Yes, absolutely.
It's important to know that, because I myself have been in practice circles where I felt like I couldn't contribute, I had nothing to contribute, and I felt pressure. Peer pressure to contribute when I really didn't want to. And so there may be others who feel like that, and they should know that they don't have to speak.
Absolutely.
And no one will think anything other than if they don't want to speak. Thank you.
Thank you. So Susan would like the mic.
What you read from Bhikkhu Bodhi is interesting in that just the other day, Gil Fronsdale and Stephen Batchelor had a hour and a half conversation on ethics, in the Buddhist ethics in today's world. So that's a topic of great interest right now at pretty high levels. I mean, Bhikkhu Bodhi is pretty high level. This conflict that you spoke of at the beginning, the way that I feel that conflict is separation. Like I feel And when I start feeling tremendous sorrow and frustration and you know, all of that,
it helps
a lot to for me to recognize that I'm not separate. from that stuff. I'm not separate from even the folks, you know, who are now dying of AIDS because of the lack of the medicine that was being provided through USAID. They're faceless to me, but they're not separate. And somehow or another, the feeling of impotency is lessened. Not that I'm able to do anything, I'm not, but the capacity for compassion is enhanced by removing the sense of separation. And that's, you know, ethereally helpful. And there's other stuff, but that's kind of the core for me, I'm finding, is when I start feeling these just, and you know, just all the anger that comes up. You know, that's based in fear, and fear comes from separation, right? So, yeah.
Hello. I agree with that about compassion. It seems to be something that's missing from a lot of people that I'm finding in this world. With me currently, for my job, I have to travel and play music for people, and so I get to meet a lot of interesting souls. And one thing that I find is the self-care, and this thing that they separate themselves and they like distract themselves with all these things, and they just remove themselves almost from the world by just digesting all these things that are distractions. And for me, I feel like it's up to us to show compassion, even in the simplest ways, as we travel along this. It's like you walk ahead and you trip over a stone, and you see someone behind you, you pick up that stone. You know, it's something like that can even just change someone's day. And like someone seeing you do that is an example of like care, you know, and to be an example of someone who has compassion is something that's very important that I'm finding. It's like a lot of people do not have that a layer between them, their small mind and the big mind. It's more they just let the small mind kind of take control of things, and they're like, I'll deal with things later, and they're not here. They're just distracted. And as I move along and talk with people, it's kind of interesting how many people tend to open up. And when you just are open with them and you sit with them and you show compassion, they want to talk to you. They want to say things to you. And it's just good if you can encourage others and show some kind of, I wouldn't say leadership, but just example of how to be a compassionate being. And you'd be surprised how many people will see that and be like, oh, why does this person feel different, you know? And that's one of those things where just something as simple as that can cause the ripple effect of many people doing that as well and being an example. And it's one of those things, as my practice lately, I've been trying to just be a better example for the people my age. And I see, especially in the musician world, so many people party, so many people do all these things that just really cause suffering, and they don't know it. It's almost like a false revelation. It's one of these things, it's like the cheap liberations of like, I don't know, they're just digesting all these things that aren't good for them. And I've done it plenty of times, but for me, now it's just a thing of being here and being present, being care for the trees, thank them for the breath that they give us. And a lot of people don't have that thought because they're just so distracted by what, like their phones and things in front of them. And as we speak to each other, I hope it's one of those things where we can encourage people to look up instead of look down at the thing that's a rectangle in their hands. And maybe through that, we can help people like find that compassion to help, and we can group together and fix these major problems. But at the moment, a lot of times people tend to be focused on their own suffering and not tend to it in a way, so they get stuck in it and get stuck in a pit. And it's one of those things where if they just feel stuck, they don't understand how to move within this void. They're just like, I'm here, I need to stay, this is what I do, and they don't see there is a way to move within it. But I feel, yeah, the key is compassion, and like we all come from the same solution, like the bubbles we were blowing that a couple of weeks ago. And we all different shapes, but we all come from the same thing. We are no different from each other. But it's one of those things we have to show that we are the same. When a homeless man sits next to you, say hi, speak to them, show them that you care, you know. That's one of those things where I'm just, as I move along, just changing the habits of looking away, you know. That's a very important thing as of late. I'm still new to all this, but it's been enriching, and I really appreciate the Sangha. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan and Brian. Jim, I'm so familiar with with that tension that you expressed about what to do in the world, but I have to say I laughed when you started talking, because I think that koan starts a teacher asking the student how are things where you came from, and the response is there's a lot of discussion. So we're carrying on that part of the tradition. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is on YouTube a lot too, by the way, and he's pretty awesome, especially in the Theravadan, covering the early teachings. So this business about suffering—it's, it's right in along. It's right in our wheelhouse, right? Beings are numberless. I vow to save them from what's suffering. It's the Bodhisattva vow. It's our grandiose, amazing intention to do what can't be done, which requires more than one person. I sharply feel the tension between what to do in the world. Susan, you guys have pardoned me for almost cross-talking, but you guys have really laid out wonderful, approaches and very valid ones. But for me, it's like I want to spend more time doing climate work, activism, that's what I do, and I want to spend more time with Dharma studies, and I already don't have enough time to do anything, any of it. But I had an interesting insight a year or two ago about that, where I was really in a retreat and feeling this tension. What should I do? How can I, what's the right balance? And it came to me that my suffering around this issue, around not knowing how to do the right thing, was because I was emotionally attached to my to two different imaginations. One of really doing Dharma work a lot, and one on doing climate work a lot. But neither one of these had any reality. They're both just imagined alternative ways of being. And that's fine, that's what minds do, and it's really fun to make stories about imagined alternatives, but I was emotionally attached to them. And so that that simplified things for me. It didn't answer my question about what to do, how to be two things at once, but it removed the confusion somewhat. The only reality is that there's only one of me, and there's more to do than I can do. And I'm at any point in time, I'm or many points in time, I'm not sure which way I should spend my energy. That's the only reality. There are options, and I have difficulty choosing. So that's probably not going to change. And basically that's what my teacher says when I present that to him. He says, well, you can't do that because then you wouldn't be studying Dharma. Well, you can't do that because then you wouldn't be protecting people anymore. Okay. So, yeah, thank you.
Recently, I read something. Actually, it was a training on resistance that really helped, I think, answer this question for me, this dichotomy of how do I practice and how do I respond to the suffering of the world. And it was a training about tyranny and how tyranny can overtake a society. And it was a very illustrative example they gave. They said, you know, there's only a few of them. There's not a lot of the dictators. There's only a few core. But the way they can take over a society and sustain themselves is they're supported by the pillars of society. The pillars of society are banking industry. The pillars of society are the education industry. The pillars of society are the religions of society. And by each of those pillars, if they don't respond or protest or call out the evil of the few, then the few will take over the society. And so the only way to respond to tyranny in society is if each one of those organizations, those pillars, religion, which is what we are, stand up and witness and say, this is wrong. This is evil. You can't do this to other people. We will put our bodies in front of you before you starve these people, the people in Gaza, and the people who are losing health care in this country. We will do everything we can to support the health care because it's wrong. And their training actually was very encouraging to me. They said that based on history, study of history, on where tyranny has tried to overcome a society, if 3.2% of the population stands up and resist, those few dictators and authoritarian people cannot sustain it. And if these pillars of society, the banking society, the business society, the commerce society, and the religions, the religious organizations, stand up and witness and say, no, this is wrong, that will crumble. And so for me, that was very encouraging as a way to become engaged and how important it was. Because if I stand silent, I'm complicit in this evil. So if I just sink into my practice, then I'm responsible for what that authoritarian government does to harm people in my society. I have to say, I caused that harm. And so for me, there isn't a dichotomy with this. My practice is what inspires me to call out the evil and to look what I can do personally to relieve the suffering of the people who are being harmed. But if nothing else, just to call it out and say, this is wrong. This is against my Buddhist ethics. It's against my Buddhist principles. It's a violation of everything that I hold sacred. Stop. And so for me, that has really helped me not see this as a dichotomy at all, but it's actually integral to my practice. If I am truly going to be true to my Buddhist ethics, then I have to stand up and say, no, this is wrong. You can't do this. and do whatever I can to help those that are being harmed and to slow down the harm in whatever way I can that's being done.
Very like that.
Thanks to everyone who's spoken so far. It's inspiring. This may sound weird, but I'm going somewhere with this, I promise. So when I grew up, you know, Star Wars was the closest thing I had to, like, religion. I mean, it's would be hard to emphasize how much the first three Star Wars has influenced my worldview and so forth. I mean, I don't think I'd be a Zen practitioner without just the prototype of the Jedi. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but it's true, you know. Anyway, so that's just context. So I don't know if anyone's seen it, but there's recently been some new Star Wars series called Andor. They just finished the second season. It's just a work of art. But maybe the best thing that's greatest art humans have ever created. So, anyway, in the second season, well, actually, let me say something else as a preamble first. So my biggest passion for, you know, activism, I guess, is wildland conservation. It's always been my, you know, what captures my attention the most, just like keeping wild spaces wild for the things that live there. And, you know, like just wildland destruction just hurts me physically, you know. And, you know, and a big part of that is climate change because, you know, like out where I live in El Dorado County, I mean, a massive swath of the forest burned down. You know, 4 years ago. And I mean, it was a lot of my favorite places just, you know, I mean, it was really, and it was directly a factor from, I mean, it's multifactorial, but a big part of it is climate change. And, you know, and it's just a fact that there's one party that is at least trying something for climate change and another party that's actively trying to make it worse. And it just, you know, with recent political events, it just made me feel like despondent. Like, we're not going to fix climate change. This is going to happen. You know, the wild spaces are just going to drastically change. You know, long term, you know, life is going to be fine. You know, but in the short term, you know, a lot of beings, non-human beings, and humans too, are going to suffer pretty horribly. And okay, so here's my point. And so I found myself feeling a little despondent. Part of me always had hope that we would pull this off, you know. But in the last four years, especially in the last 6 months, I just felt like, you know, it's just going to happen. There's nothing we can do. And I was just feeling, like, defeated and despondent. And I was cleaning out my car the other day, and we'd been on a road trip, so there's a lot of trash in it. And I had a bag that had trash and sparkling water cans. And maybe for the first time in my life, like, I don't feel like taking the cans out. And I put the cans in the trash can, which was like a big deal for me. Like, I don't think I've ever done that in my life, you know. But it was almost like symbolic of my just like giving up. Like, this is like, we're not going to win. Like, who cares, you know? And then there was, so this episode in the second season of Andor, where is one of the first scenes actually where one of the main stars is like stealing a top secret weapon from the Empire so they could like research it and know how to be. And by the way, when Trump was elected, I changed my Facebook thing to the Rebel Star Wars symbol. And but you know, the Empire's evil, you know, and so these rebels, they're doing what they can to fight the Empire. And anyway, so here's the scene is, so the main guy, Andor, he's going to steal this new, like, experimental TIE fighter and so they can take it and figure out how to fight against it. And one of the engineers, who's just a civilian, but she works for the Empire, you know, because, the Empire, the entire society became the Empire, just like regular working people, you know. And so, but But she decided she just didn't feel right about it, so she worked to give like the special access codes to Andor so he could steal the thing. And they have a little meeting when she's like setting them up and giving them the access codes. And she says, like, you know, like I don't remember exactly, but she's like, is this worth it? Like, you know, if I die tonight because of what I'm doing here, you know, is there any chance we're going to actually beat the Empire? Was this worth it? You know? And Andor says something that I thought was brilliant. I mean, obviously it was the voice of the writers, but he was saying, like, what's important is how you feel at this moment. You just wouldn't be able to live with yourself if you weren't on the right, I'm paraphrasing heavily, but if you're not on the right side of history here, it would just feel horrible, right? You're doing what you're doing because it's just, and again, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, it puts you in alignment with your values, you know, and that is what's important here. Not whether we end up winning against the Empire, but we're just doing what we have to do because it aligns with our values. And you know, next time I was faced with the thing where with the trash and the cans, I took the cans out and separated from the trash, because even if it's just not going to make a difference in the long run, it aligns with my values and it felt right, you know. And so that's kind of been helpful to me. Like, even if in the short term we're not going to win the fight against climate change, still I want to do what's aligned with my values, and that feels wholesome and in alignment with my Buddhist vows.
Okay. Well, Millard, you want to go ahead, and then we'll go to Dave, and probably we're going to be.
I'm not going to take too much time. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
What's your name? What's the gentleman's name next to you, Jim?
Bryant.
Brian.
Bryant, I think.
Bryant, hello.
I just wanted to say I really took in what you had to say. But what I'm going to say is pretty short. It's more wag, less bark. Brian understands. More wag, less bark every moment of the day.
Well, no cross talk, but so I'm not surprised at that. Segueing back to Buddhism, if that's okay. Personally, 50 years ago, what was going on with the administrations at that time angered me incredibly. Nowadays, I'm just incredibly sad from it. In keeping with the practice, I kind of look to who are some of our teachers. And, you know, there's a wide range. I think many of you are familiar with Osho Uchiyama, the Japanese teacher, writer, interpreter of Dogen, who came of age during World War II in great poverty. And he says in a couple of places in his writing that, you know, what to do about the state of the world? He says, just be a nice person. Just be a good person. That's it. At the other end of the spectrum, you have Joanna Macy, who just passed away, who was a great Buddhist teacher and a tremendous activist, whose writings on the Dharma and climate change, have affected many. And between that, I think a lot of us, many of us want to do a lot more than what Uchiyama suggests, but very, very few of us have the drive and charisma of a Joanna Macy. But we can help those right in front of us. I will tell a little story, a story that I heard a few years ago that made a big impact on me, and perhaps many of you have heard it already, but you have to listen to a rerun. There was a big storm came up on the coast, big storm, big waves, and when the tide went out, the storm abated, there were these thousands of starfish that washed up on the beach. Thousands, stretching down the beach as far as you could see. And there was an old man who was picking them up one by one, taking them to the water, which the tide was going out, was receding each time. He had to go a little bit further, and he'd toss starfish back in the water. And someone else came up and said, "What on earth are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm putting the starfish back in the water." He says, "Well, that's nuts. I mean, there's thousands of these things. You can't, what are you going to do?" You know, he says, and the old man, he didn't really pay too much attention and picked up another starfish, took it down to the water, tossed it in. And he says, "It's nuts. What does it matter?" And the old man takes starfish, tosses it in the water, and he said, "It mattered to that one."
Well, I think we could. Susan wants to speak.
I will be short. I appreciate that you've brought this subject up a lot. For myself, I kind of am in mourning all the time. I'm just sad every time I look at anything. It reminds me a little bit of when I lost somebody very close to me. I just am grieving. And I'm grieving, I realize, what I believed was where we were going in a positive direction. And that's a really abstract thing, and that is a wonderful dream. And, in fact, it isn't true. And so I grieve the loss of that dream, but I still think it's a good dream. To break out of the pain of the grief, I look for myself, I give money to lawyers because I think the institutions that were helping us are falling apart, and it's mostly legal people that can address that. But day to day, I try to to live with that grief and not let it go to anger, and also work the thing I feel strongly that's happened is that we've really stopped listening to each other, and we stopped caring about how things were hurting people that weren't like us. And so I really try to do something about opening up and seeing if I can listen better, and also what I can possibly do to help people move to live with the sadness, and instead of anger, find something else. I mean, when you're in pain and grief, you just can't be there every second. So what you do is you stop for a minute and you do the simplest thing, make yourself dinner, whatever. You just give yourself a break from the grief, but you don't pretend that you're not grieving. So that's how I use my practice to hang in there. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.